This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. This hour, colleges were supposed to be back to business as usual by this school year, but the Delta variant has thrown administrators a curveball. What's the view from the Quad? Also, why eliminating clutter at home and work can be good for your mental health. Also, the gloomy climate change report from the UN recently included a glimmer of hope. We'll talk about that coming up on Top of Mind. It's great to have you with us today. Colleges welcoming students back to campus this fall had hoped the COVID-19 pandemic would be over by now. I mean, we all did, honestly. Instead, though, infections are surging and university administrators are in a bind. Do they mandate vaccines on campus, require masks, go back to online only? And they're wrestling with all of this against the backdrop of political pressures and even state mandates in some cases that limit what they can do with things like masks or vaccines. Kate Bellows is tracking this for the Chronicle of Higher Education, where she's a reporting fellow, and she's with me now. Kate, thanks for your time. Welcome.
Hi, Julie. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you. You were recently on the campus of the University of Alabama at Birmingham, which is kind of a microcosm of a lot of the pressures that campuses are facing. Tell us what you saw there, what you encountered.
So on the one hand, I saw all the normal goings on you'd expect for the first day of class, students on electric scooters, friends greeting friends that they hadn't seen in a while, lots of freshmen and their lanyards. But then underlying this joy, there's a sense that things aren't totally back to normal. And you can see that it's physically present. Masks are required. At the same time, vaccination rates at the start of classes are not where administrators would like them to be. They're at 54% for students and 70% for faculty and staff the last time I checked in with the administration, which was last week around this time. So it's a mix of excitement and also concern. And that's, you can feel that on campus.
Did students seem happy to be there in person?
Yes, I definitely, every student I spoke to said that they were really happy to be there. The student I spoke to the most was Kafui Saki Ado, and she was a student who left during her freshman year and came back during her junior year on campus. She didn't leave school. It was just that the campus shut down during freshman year of college, and then she it reopened this year, junior year. And so, you know, for her, going online, she told me, was a massive adjustment and a strain on her mental health. And so she's really ready to be back in person. She got the vaccine. She was really excited to see her friends. I followed her around a little bit and saw her like reunite with her friends and, you know, get popsicles from the campus green. So it was a really exciting time for her. I think she also felt those hesitations about how the concerns about the Delta variant, that those could take away the semester that she'd been promised as a normal fall.
Almost kind of holding her breath, like this feels maybe too good to be true.
That's what I heard from a lot of students, that there was this concern that we're back in person. It's so great. Yay. But what if this is all taken away from us? What if we have to go back to remote? Can I do this for very much longer? And I heard that from another student who told me that she was excited. She was worried that she would get too excited. She was worried that it would get ripped away from her.
Oh.
Basically, the pandemic in general has been devastating for young people's social lives and the elderly. But in this context, no one has felt it more than those teens.
Hmm. Did you talk to any students who were worried about it? About, like, I hope this is safe.
I definitely did. I would say students felt ambiguous about it. So I spoke to students who said that, you know, they had lost relatives to COVID or that they had relatives who were sick. And so I think for them, it was exciting. And there was some a sense I felt when I was speaking to them of guilt that they were back and there was also so much suffering going around. One thing to note about UAB, the University of Alabama at Birmingham, is that everyone, all the leadership I spoke to told me that this is probably the safest place to be in Birmingham because it has a higher rate of vaccination than the county as a whole. And then also just the fact that masks are required. So I think the students felt much safer to be there than they did elsewhere in the county or in the state as a whole. They told me that they felt that the administration was looking out for them. That was the impression that I got.
Yeah. Well, it's so much depends then, I imagine, wherever you are in the country, kind of what's going on in your community versus what's happening on your campus. Can you speak to a kind of a more general sense? What are the most common sort of like COVID protocols that we see campuses? It's fair to say that most colleges have brought their students back, attempted to try to bring their students back for full-time learning.
Yes, nearly all have gone back to full-time. You're seeing this week, last week, some universities, colleges and universities transitioning to hybrid because of the surge in the Delta variant. But in terms of the most common COVID safety protocols, it's really hard to require distancing because it's just hard to regulate it. But you can do this by reducing class size. So you would see when I was in classes, students were spread out. I don't know if those classes had been reduced from the normal, but students were spread out as much as they could be, 3 feet and more. Also the biggest thing, the thing that many administrators say that they want to do, even if they can't, at the University of Alabama, they're not, and Birmingham, they're not allowed to under state law, is to require vaccines. The chronic cause of vaccine tracker, last time I checked, it was at 1,014 campuses that are requiring students, employees, or both to receive the coronavirus vaccine. The colleges that are requiring it are mostly concentrated on the West Coast and in the Northeast. Hmm. And we found a strong correlation between the way a state votes in the 2020 presidential election and their vaccine requirements. So it's become very politicized. So that is kind of the main and most controversial requirement to reduce COVID cases on campus.
So at a place like the University of Alabama at Birmingham in the South, the administrators would love to be able to say either you get vaccinated or you don't come, but they're unable to because their state legislature has acted or their governor has.
Yeah, the governor has. I would say during my reporting there, the leaders that I spoke to there hedged a bit about how they felt personally about requiring the vaccine, simply because, as they told me, it wasn't an option. So I wasn't really able to find out exactly what the reasoning was or how they felt about it, but they aren't allowed to. So Governor Kay Ivey in May signed a law banning colleges in Alabama from requiring the vaccine as a condition of enrollment. Mm. And so according to our vaccine tracker, no college in Alabama, public or private, is currently requiring the vaccine. There are other states that have similar laws, Florida, Texas, Arizona. But you do have private and for-profit schools there that are requiring the vaccine.
And masks, is a mask mandate something that's fairly common all across the country? Are there that many universities, do you think, where like not even masks are being requested or required?
Sure. So, there are some states where this has come in conflict between the universities and the Department of Education and the state administration. No state, I would say, has become more well known for mask controversies than South Carolina. Alabama, just to say, doesn't have a requirement saying that colleges and public schools can't require the mask. But in South Carolina, the flagship university, the University of South Carolina, tried to institute a mask mandate. And it was in effect for a couple of days before they received a letter from the attorney general saying that it was a violation of the state law that said that they weren't public universities aren't public schools and universities aren't allowed to institute mask mandates. So they rescinded it once they received this letter. A professor who had his wife is high risk, has immunocompromised, sued for clarification from the Supreme Court of South Carolina. And the Supreme Court ruled that USC and other public colleges in the state could institute mask requirements. Hmm. So now those are in effect in South Carolina.
Interesting.
It was a different proviso in South Carolina from the one that doesn't allow primary schools to require masking. So that is still a big controversy for kids in elementary, middle, and high school.
Yeah. So colleges all across the country really then are sort of caught in this firestorm of political and public health concerns. Kate Bellows, what kinds of procedures or plans are colleges typically making for the inevitable wave of infection that will, you know, or a COVID outbreak that will affect the whole floor of a dorm, or, you know, you might, or a hotspot in a classroom, for example? How are they going to deal with that?
Isolation is the biggest one. So having dorms that are specifically for students who are isolating during their bout with coronavirus, whether they're sick or not, they still have to quarantine. So often the students are in off-campus locations or dorms that are specifically designated for quarantine housing. You're also seeing colleges that are trying to reduce transmission by prohibiting or otherwise regulating indoor activities. Stanford, I just read a headline today, according to the Stanford Daily, which is their student newspaper, they've prohibited indoor student parties. That will go on until October 8th. So that's a major regulation for reducing rates. But again, it goes against students who want to socialize. That could be very frustrating, create a rift between the administration and students, because Stanford is requiring the vaccine. So I think for a lot of students, this is very frustrating to have to deal with.
Yeah. Are campuses and colleges and universities under any legal obligation to like keep COVID cases in their community under a certain threshold?
Things like that depend from state to state or change from state to state. So that's very hard to regulate. Many colleges will implement requirements or further restrictions when cases get to a certain level.
So they'll kind of set their own targets and sort of say, like, here's the trigger point where we implement phase, you know, red alert phase or orange alert or whatever of our restrictions. Are they required to monitor? I mean, I guess federally the CDC requires counting, but are the campuses required to report, to let their community know, here's how much vaccination we have and here how many infections we've had, that kind of thing?
That's another thing that varies from state to state and especially from campus to campus. You'll have two universities or colleges within the same city and they'll have totally different requirements on masks, perhaps even on vaccines, and how they present those numbers. So I just finished an article last week about vaccine dashboards and how totally different they are from school to school and how confusing it can be to compare them.
Just because the campus administration, the university decides what to report, how to report it. I mean, it's kind of just up to them.
Yes, it's very case by case. It's very dependent on the particular university. For example, I've compared in the article the University of Colorado to Colorado State University, and they have the same vaccine policy or very similar vaccine policies, but their dashboards are completely different in terms of what numbers they're presenting, how the dashboards themselves look, and which students and faculty and staff they're counting. So it really depends on the university, how those numbers are presented. Dashboards are a very important public reporting tool. They disrupt the narrative that students are irresponsible, because it shows that students have higher vaccination rates in general, not at every campus, than faculty and staff. And also it can help students and parents and faculty feel safe on their campus if they see that it has a higher vaccination rate.
I'm speaking with Kate Bellows, who is a reporting fellow at the Chronicle of Higher Education, monitoring how colleges and universities across the country are coping with back to school in the middle of what is an unexpected, I guess. If we were to look back 6 months ago, campuses were planning on a certain reality that now we're dealing with a wave, a surge in COVID cases that they probably had hoped would not be interrupting their activities. What are you hearing from the faculty and staff responsible for making the education happen on these campuses?
I think they feel, the ones that I've spoken to, have expressed similar concerns to students I've spoken to, concerns about their safety, the safety of their family members. They are very excited to go back to class in person because, as they've told me, it's very hard to teach hybrid courses, to teach a class that has an online component and a class that is has an in-person component. I remember being in first grade and I was in a class that was mixed with first graders and second graders, and the teacher would switch in between the first graders and second graders. And my impression from these faculty is that it's somewhat like that. You're switching in between two different courses at the same time. And it's very difficult, and it's very, a lot of pressure. So you're seeing, a bit of a choking effect on faculty that are working during this pandemic. You're seeing burnout for staff and faculty. It's been a very difficult year and a half.
If they hadn't planned on offering like a concurrent Zoom option, you know, for students who are remote, how are they going to cope with isolation and quarantine requirements when students in their courses have to, you know, check out for 2 weeks, basically?
I think that's something that a lot of the colleges haven't figured out, because, and the whole angle of our story is that colleges were going back to school this fall, thinking that things were going to finally be normal after so long. And to everyone's disappointment, that is not the way that things have panned out. So all of the planning that was set in place for a fully in-person semester has kind of gone out the window. And then you're trying to come up with new plans. This university is trying to come up with new plans for quarantine housing, for virtual schooling that they didn't think that they were going to need. So I think it's been challenging. And honestly, the impression that I got from faculty is that they're exhausted.
How much does the pressure of finance, that the need that many colleges have to collect tuition from students who only want to pay that if they're going to be on campus, how much does that financial pressure seem to be driving the decisions that we see schools making right now about what to do this semester?
Our reporting shows that it's a large factor. Schools want students to come back to campus. It's not just tuition. It's also room, board, the economic benefits that college students bring to college towns. Those make a difference. But at the same time, colleges are weighing those considerations against health and safety risks, which also bring incredible financial risks of their own. If a student gets sick or dies and their family sues the university for not keeping their students safe, it is also a financial consideration, these health and safety concerns.
So can you imagine a scenario where a college would pull the plug on in-person learning?
I don't have to imagine it. I mean, that has happened.
Already, that, even during this back-to-school, even during this back-to-school cycle.
That they have taken breaks from that, or for the first 2 weeks of classes, colleges have given professors opportunities to go back to hybrid courses, because a lot of professors have demanded that. At Clemson, you had professors threatening to walk out on class because they wanted a hybrid option. I haven't seen a campus that has said that for the rest of the semester will be virtual, but I have seen campuses that have said for at least a month or something like that, some period of time, we're going to be hybrid or be virtual to protect the health and safety of our students.
Mm. So that would be something typically up then to the administration, and they're kind of just hoping, all right, whatever we're allowed to do, we're going to hope this works. A little bit of spacing, maybe slightly smaller classes, quarantine rules, maybe accessible testing. And then we're just going to, like, fingers crossed that this wave crests and things ease up. But here's our sort of like pull the plug moment when we hit a certain threshold or have a certain outbreak, and then you might see kind of just temporary disruption. Is that a pretty fair assessment of what we're going to be seeing across the country here?
Yes, I would say so. I think there's a lot of finger crossing.
Kate Bellows is a reporting fellow at the Chronicle of Higher Education. Thank you very much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Julie.
This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. Coming up in about 15 minutes, why was the latest UN climate science report so dire? And is there anything we can do to head off the worst case scenario? Just ahead, the trouble with having a cluttered workspace. Thanks for tuning in to Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. Good to have you with us. Are you feeling burned out at the office? Maybe you're exhausted from working remotely. A cluttered office might be contributing to that. Psychologist Joseph Ferrari studies clutter and its effect on us. He is the St. Vincent de Paul Distinguished Professor of Psychology at DePaul University in Chicago, and he's with us now. Professor Ferrari, welcome. Thanks for taking time today.
Thank you for calling on time. Thank you, Julie. I appreciate this.
How do you define clutter?
All right. Very good question. Common question. Clutter is not the same as hoarding, being a clutterer. I like to think of the difference as hoarding, you have lots of the same stuff. So think of that as vertical. Where clutter, it's horizontal. It's just a lot of breadth of material. There's an organization that my colleague and I, Dr. Catherine Roster from the business school at University of New Mexico, an organization that we partner with to study the effects of clutter. And it's the Institute for Challenging Disorganization. It's the international group of decluttering coaches. And they will tell you that the first problem with clutter is people are disorganized. Even the name, Institute of Challenging Disorganization, gives the suggestion. They tell you don't run out and buy containers and start putting things away, but organize, because that information is rich. You see how much stuff you really have.
Okay, so isn't it though a little bit subjective? Like, you might walk into my office and say there's a lot of clutter, and I would say I know where every single thing is, and it's exactly where I need it to be. In my office.
Yes, it's interesting. For me, I look at it and I say, look at all your, another SH word people will say, look at all the stuff you have. And you say, no, that's my stuff. It's very interesting. And that ties in nicely, Julie, with a gender difference. In the first study that Dr. Roster and I did, we had over 1,600 adults who professed, who claimed to have a clutter problem. But only 50 of them were men. So the first question I ask, is there a gender difference? Mm-hmm. Is that we have so many women compared to this? And these ICD experts said, no. Men have clutter problems too, but they don't see it as clutter. They see it as their stuff, their toys, their hobbies. So you're absolutely right.
So are there, you defining, it has to be stuff. It's not necessarily junk. It's not necessarily useless. It's stuff that matters to you. It's just that it doesn't have, it's chaotic. It's disorderly.
It's an overabundance of that material.
Okay.
And yes, it can be junk. Okay. In the home studies that you, in the office studies that you were talking about, we asked people the first time, what is the clutter? Can you tell me what it is? And what we found for people who are working at home or people working in a business setting, the top three, they were asked to list the top five, but the top three that consistently came out was paper. People have lots of piles of paper for things that they don't necessarily need. Trash, and by trash, we mean used coffee cups, styrofoam cups, plastic forks, things like that. Mm. And then office supplies. How many Post-it notes do you need? Do you really need to have every paperclip from here to China and back, you know? So those are the types of things that people have. Now, you might say that's just stuff. Yeah, but it's disorganized and it's interfering with the quality of their life.
In what way? How does it interfere?
Well, people report, okay, both at home. The first paper that Roster and I did was called The Dark Side of Home, because we really looked at it in the home, and we found that people reported that the more material goods they had, the more clutter they had, the less life satisfaction. So we live in this culture that says, buy, 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 like Gloria Gaynor, more, 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 you know, that we have to have. And if you don't have it, you're not a happy person. And yet the data shows we tend to be more less happy with that, more upset with the quality of our life, the more materials we have. In the following set of studies, when we looked at the home, which is what you contacted me about.
The office, you mean.
We looked at the office. Right. We found the same kind of things, that the more clutter you have in the office, the lower your productivity, the lower your job satisfaction, the more office exhaustion, emotional exhaustion, burnout you will have. So
does it
really
only
isn't a positive thing.
But does it only harm me if it bothers me? I mean, if I say this isn't clutter, it's my stuff. I know where it is. I need it. I'm fine with it. It's amazing. You can have an inability to see the clutter around you, right? If it doesn't bother me, is it affecting me negatively?
Okay. Well, first of all, life is not about me. Life is about we. So while it may not affect you directly, it may be impacting on your ability to do the best job you can. That would help others. I mean, one of the areas that I'm known for studying is chronic procrastination. And that's exactly right. One of the things we looked at also, Dr. Roster and I, and my graduate students, and I have looked at was the role of clutter on procrastination and procrastinators and their clutter. And we found that it isn't that it's just affecting you. You're not meeting deadlines efficiently. You're not getting things done.
So that's happening.
That are impacting on the lives of other people.
Right. But
they need to get things done.
I want to, and I'm not saying like it doesn't bother me. I'm fine with the consequences. What I'm wondering is if I don't realize that clutter, that I have clutter.
Right.
How much of this is about me being like, oh, there's so much clutter. And then it's like, that's like the psychological effect of bringing me down. Like if I recognize I'm in a cluttered workspace, and that's part of what
I understand the question. And it's a good question. And that might be why we're finding this gender difference in perception. You know, in terms of clutter, they've got the same, but the men just don't see it as a problem.
Yeah.
Women, maybe because in our culture, rightly, wrongly, let's not go there, but are told, you know, that they have to uphold an image and that kind of stuff. And so they feel, oh, I've got too much stuff and I don't need all this stuff. The areas that people have the most clutter are the kitchen, the closet, and the bookcase.
And does it matter if I have control over it? So if I'm in a shared space, and I mean, this happens at home, obviously, but let's think about a workspace, right? There is such a thing as a cluttered workspace in which it's, you know, there's sort of like spare chairs everywhere and things kind of piled up here and there. And it's not my office, my specific workspace, but it is the cluttered office. Does it matter if it's mine? Does that affect people?
Well, that's an interesting twist. If it was yours and I walked in and said, can you get me the Johnson account, and you have to spend 20 minutes looking for it, that's a problem.
Sure.
It may not have been a problem to you, but I needed the Johnson account because he's on the phone or something like that. You know. But if it's an office that everybody knows is cluttered, then we'd all walk in there and go, where the heck is that Johnson folder and all that information for the Johnson account? So it can affect all of us. So that's a good question. I'm not sure we have an answer to that.
What about
you're talking? Go ahead.
Yeah, because I was going to
say
thinking
that
how much
Dr. Roster and I are really the only ones who study this topic. So you've got great questions. We don't have the answers yet. I invite the listeners to let's start doing some good social, community, industrial, organizational, IO research and look at the fact of clutter. Go ahead.
Why is this a topic that you're interested in so passionately, Professor Ferrari?
Okay. Well, because I met Roster at one of these ICD conferences, and she's a consumer psychologist. And so they look at why people buy their things and what did they hold on to. So this seems very up her alley. And I'm interested as a social community psychologist on the meaning of home. What does home mean to us? Not the physical dwelling, but the notion of home. Travel and I can't wait to go home. You eat me out of house and home. We put people in a nursing home. Interesting. The one negative thing we can still say today is that if you don't have a house, you're houseless. homeless. People are not homeless. People are houseless. Mm. Many homeless adults and children have communities, but that's still considered, but that's considered somehow you're less than other people. So as a social psychologist, community psychologist, I'm really interested in what is home? And so then we partnered and we began to look at home and clutter and how does that impact on the quality of people's lives? And we're finding people are reporting, I'm not happy. So maybe it is subjective, Julie, but they're saying I'm not happy. Yeah. My life isn't happy because I now have all this stuff that I was told I have to buy. What? People will have over $7,000 worth of materials in their home that they don't use. That's a lot. That's a lot of information, a lot of stuff that we have that we've thrown money at because somewhere along the line, someone said, oh, you got to have this. You're not complete without that.
But can you, if you have a big enough house or a big enough office with enough places to put stuff, then you might not have a clutter problem. I mean, you might still have an overconsumption.
So what do? We buy storage containers. We put pods in our driveway. Exactly. Because we've got to get more, right? We clutter in the closets. We clutter in the attic, in the basements, more. So let's build a new wing for more.
What causes, aside from the urge to consume and overconsume, what causes clutter? Are there psychological causes? Are there certain types of people or personalities who struggle with it more?
Yeah, that's a good question too. I remember, hoarding is a psychiatric disorder. It's a psychological. Clutter is not. It hasn't raised to that level yet. There's a lot of intervention and clinical work that has been done, diagnostic work on hoarding, and there's more that can be done for sure. But I can't really answer with clutter because we haven't really studied that. And it doesn't raise to the level of being diagnosed of that.
Do you find, though, that people who are feeling overworked are also, sometimes clutter is just about like, that thing has been sitting on my desk all this time because I don't really have the right place for it. Like, I know I need it, but the energy it's going to take for me to create a new folder or to figure out and then to like remember where I put it, like that is almost like fatigue can cause clutter.
I don't think one folder is the problem. The problem is when you have 18 of those folders and they're all like that. That's the issue. It's the quantity. It's the overabundance. And look, it's okay, going back to an earlier question, to have attachments to things. We just don't have to worship those things. We don't have to make them the center point of our life. We should be creating relationships, not collecting relics. We should be looking for the memories of things and not the material things. You haven't even gone down the path, which is fine, thank you, of what to do if you have all this clutter.
Well, that's the next question, okay. I guess.
Thing the ICD decluttering coaches would tell you, and I would tell any of the listeners, if you really feel this is an issue, reach out locally for a member. Go to the website, ICD, and look them up, and they'll have people locally. And the first thing they will come to your house will help you organize. They'll make you see, wow, you have 18 spatulas and 15 blue pairs of pans. And do you really need those extra 5 piles of books that are on the floor? So they have you organize. Then they tell you is not to touch it yourself, because if you touch it, all right, you're more likely to keep it. That's what consumer psychologists say. Companies, products are placed on certain shelves locations because they want you to touch it, because the companies know if you touch that product, you'll buy it. So you don't hold it. You have the decluttering coach or a friend hold it up and say, do you really need these 15 pairs of blue pants? Do you really think the Nehru jacket's going to come back? Do you, how many leisure suits do you still have to have on? If any of your listeners know what I'm talking about, all right? Because people say, you never know, it's going to come back. Yeah, but we know it'll come back, but it won't be quite the same Nehru jacket or the leisure suit. And it's because it's suddenly different, you put on the old one, you're going to look weird, okay? So, no, it doesn't really come back. Oh, someday I'll fit in it. Good luck on that one. Because we don't.
And just finally, Professor Ferrari, how can a company encourage less clutter?
Oh, great idea. I would have decluttering parties. have those bins that people can recycle stuff with, and whoever loads up the most gets a free pizza. That, I don't know, some sort of incentive. We need to incentivize things, give people reinforcers, not punishers as a culture. That's a whole topic for the procrastination. We punish people for being late, for not doing things, but we don't reward people when they do things early. And so the same kind of thing, reward people for doing the project. So if you're in the business setting, all right, have the client, have the employee throw out, I know somebody's doing this challenge for the month of September. Every day you have to throw out one thing representing that day. So today is what, the 7th? So 7 things have to be thrown out. Tomorrow is the 8th. 8 things you have to throw out.
Wow.
So every day of the month. So that'd be an interesting idea. And whoever is able to do all that wins. I know some people that are doing that. That's a great little thing. So you create, come up with some creative ways to incentivize it, to make it interesting and something appealing for people to want to do.
Joseph Ferrari is the St. Vincent de Paul Distinguished Professor of Psychology at DePaul University in Chicago. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you so much, Julie. And don't forget, declutter.
This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. Coming up next, why was the latest UN climate science report so dire? And is there anything we can do to head off the worst case scenario? I'm Julie Rose. It's good to have you with us today for Top of Mind. In a little under 2 months, global leaders will meet in Glasgow for the United Nations Climate Change Conference to assess the international commitment to reducing carbon emissions. The stakes for this summit are particularly high because of the latest report from the UN's panel of climate change scientists, which concluded that carbon emissions from human activity have already done irreversible damage to the planet. But the scientists also say it's not yet too late to head off the worst-case scenarios. What will that take? Rutgers University climate scientist Robert Kopp is one of the lead authors on the latest UN climate report, and he's with us now on the line. Professor Kopp, thanks for taking time today.
Sure, my pleasure.
What exactly is irreversible at this point with regard to climate change?
Well, sure. So every ton of carbon dioxide we put into the atmosphere, as well as the other greenhouse gases we emit, like methane, creates a little bit more warming for the planet. And that warming lasts for many centuries to millennia. So essentially, right, we've warmed about 1.1 degrees Celsius, nearly 2 degrees Fahrenheit, since the end of the 19th century. So effectively, from human perspective, that warming is irreversible.
Is it because, and so that if means, we, sorry, but it, does that mean then that if next month, by some, for some crazy reason, we stopped putting greenhouse gases into the atmosphere globally, that wouldn't just sort of automatically push the rewind button?
No. So that warming that we've already experienced is essentially locked in. There are people who talk about ways of accelerating the removal of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere using technologies that don't really exist right now, right? And so maybe there are solutions like that. But in terms of what we can do now, the 1.1 degrees Celsius of warming, 2 degrees Fahrenheit of warming we've already experienced, that's effectively irreversible. And so okay. The changes we're already seeing, right? So the more intense heat waves, the more intense rainfall, higher sea levels, right? Those are all locked in.
To expand on that for me, what are the symptoms that we are currently experiencing as a result of that irreversible warming?
Yeah, so there are a number of things, and the level of evidence varies for each, but the things that we can most clearly point to and say, like, indisputably, these are affected by climate change include the fact that we're on a warmer planet, so heat waves are more frequent and more intense. We have a warmer atmosphere, so when we have rain, we get more intense rain because warmer atmosphere can hold warm water vapor. And, I'm in New Jersey, and we just had some really devastating rainfall just a few days ago. My basement flooded for the first time since I've lived here. And that's that's a symptom of climate change. Droughts. So in a warmer climate, you get more evaporation. And so that means you get more drought. And so there are also things like wildfires, like we see in the West. The combination of drought and heat makes that more likely. And then sea level rise, which is where my own area of focus, right? So that's already caused coastal flooding to be more frequent and more more frequent and higher. And those sorts of changes we locked in the ocean, and the ice sheets last even longer. They'll last for millennia compared to the changes, the warming I've talked about. So the counterpoint of the fact that the warming is irreversible, it's also true that if we were to stop emitting tomorrow, as you said, like, we would also basically stop warming the planet. So the flip side of yes, that warming's locked in is there's not a lot more locked in. Like, we, you know, if we were to stop emitting CO2 today, we wouldn't keep getting much more warming for much longer. So it's definitely within our power to slow down the rate at which these things are changing and to stabilize the climate.
What's the scenario if we just keep on doing what we're doing today?
Yeah, well, so basically every ton of carbon dioxide we emit causes roughly the same amount of warming. We're currently warming up the planet at about 0.2 degrees Celsius or close to about 0.4 degrees Fahrenheit per decade. And so if we keep emitting carbon dioxide at the current rate, we'll keep warming at that rate. And so all the changes we've already seen with the heat and the intense rainfall, droughts, sea level, right? Those things are going to continue to get worse as we continue to put greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. The only way to stabilize the climate is to get carbon dioxide emissions to zero and sharply reduce emissions of other greenhouse gases.
Okay, so that's what it'll take to get to the better outcome. Yeah. We'll talk about that in a second because that's a heavy lift. But you say that the worst case, just continuing to do what we're doing, actually does lead to the kind of the worst case scenario, which is more of the same or more intense of the same, like we're going to have even worse droughts, even worse storms, or just like they'll happen more often?
Yeah, both, right? I mean, so the trends that we've already seen, right, those, you know, that's just from a little over 1 degree Celsius of warming. The ambitious targets laid out in the Paris Agreement, you know, that's to limit warming to well below 2 degrees Celsius. So that's twice as much change almost as we've already experienced. Current policies, most likely, this is not assessed in this report, but other studies suggest that we're sort of on track for around 3 degrees Celsius by the end of the century. And if we don't get to net zero emissions, we keep getting more warming beyond that. But you know, that's sort of a useful metric, right? So basically triple the amount of change we've already had. That's sort of where current policies get us by the end of the century.
How do we know this isn't just a periodic warming trend that would have happened with or without humans burning fossil fuels?
Well, you know, my background and the background of many of the other authors is in paleoclimate. So that is, we have geology and paleoceanography that tells us what changes were like in the past. And so one of the things that is very clear is that we are seeing changes that are unprecedented, in some cases for thousands of years, in some cases for over a million years. So carbon dioxide concentrations in the atmosphere today are higher than any point in the last at least 2 million years. The rate of global warming over the last half century is faster than any time in at least 2,000 years, and probably much longer than that. Sea level has risen faster over the last century than during any century in at least 3,000 years. So it's actually, you know, that the context of natural variability, and as I said, like my background is as a geologist studying paleoclimate, paleo sea level. That's what allows us to look at what's going on now and say, you know, this is really unprecedented.
And how can we know what was going on? How do we know what was going on 3,000 years ago? What does the paleo science mean?
As I said, so it's you know, we're geology, right? So if you think about temperature, so fossils of different microorganisms, little critters called foraminifera. Their chemistry records the temperatures of the water in which they formed. For sea level, we can look at sediments deposited by ancient salt marshes and look at their depth today and how old they are and figure out what sea level was in the past. Atmospheric concentrations, you know, we can look at bubbles of old air trapped in ice, and that tells us, look at what the atmosphere was like in the past. So geology is really key to helping us figure out, you know, that we're going through changes that are really, as I said, unprecedented. We can figure out what natural variability is, and this is not natural variability.
And why are climate scientists like yourself more confident today than they were even 10 years ago in attributing these changes to humans? What's changed to make you more confident in that?
Yeah. So, I mean, there are two basic changes. One is we've gotten several tenths of a degree more warming. And so the changes are clearer. Another is that sort of the models we use to simulate extreme events have improved. And third is also like we have a clearer way of thinking about attribution, right? So, you know, you go back a decade, people were really chasing after the idea, well, was this particular weather event caused by climate change? Mm-hmm. And that's really the wrong way of thinking about it, right? Weather is complicated and dynamic and it happens, but every weather event on the planet today is happening in a planet that is almost 2 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than it was in the late 19th century. So really the question we tend to ask today is not, did climate change cause this weather event, but how did climate change affect this weather event? And so that's what we know. Well, you know, you can't say that climate change caused Hurricane Ida and its intense winds and intense rains. But what you can say is that you can quantify, and people will, I guarantee you, be quantifying this much more precisely over the coming months, but you can quantify, well, its rainfall is more intense because of climate change. And then I can say, well, my basement wouldn't have flooded had, you know, had the rain just been slightly less intense. So I'm actually quite comfortable saying my basement flooded because of climate change, because I know that the storm is more intense because that's what happens in a warmer atmosphere. It's get more intense rain. And likewise, you know, these intense winds, right? We expect hurricanes in a warmer climate to intensify more rapidly. And so what we saw with Ida is consistent with that.
Speaking with Rutgers University climate scientist Robert Kopp, he's one of the lead authors on the UN's latest Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change assessment report just came out. So what is it that we have to do as a globe, a global community, to stop things from getting worse?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And I think your emphasis on a global community is important because this really is a challenge that has to be tackled globally. It affects our entire economy around the world, because the physics tells us, as I started with, right, every ton of carbon dioxide we put into the atmosphere creates a little bit more warming, and that warming is effectively irreversible on timescales we care about. And so if we want to stabilize the climate, which we should if we don't want, heat waves and heavy rainfall and droughts and coastal floods to keep getting more intense, we have to get net CO2 emissions globally to zero.
What does that mean? Net zero.
Yeah, right. So any carbon dioxide we keep putting into the atmosphere, any fossil fuels we keep burning, we have to balance that by accelerating the natural processes that remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. So as I alluded to, right, there are some very speculative technologies people are working on to remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and then, say, bury it underground or trap it in limestone. When we talk about net emissions, that's effectively what we mean. Or, you know, expanding.
What are the natural ways?
Area.
What is the natural cycle that we could sort of help along or give a boost to?
Yeah. So when we put carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, about half of it stays up there. About a quarter goes into the surface ocean and about a quarter goes into the land biosphere. So, for instance, into forests. So one of the things, you know, that we know would work, and it's just a land use question, right, is one, stopping deforestation and then actually expanding the forested area on the planet. That's one of the things that would accelerate the removal of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. That on its own is not going to be sufficient to get us to net zero if we're still burning a lot of fossil fuels, right?
So we have to put none into the atmosphere then, basically.
So the scenarios that involve when we look at what happens in the future, we use scenarios, right? Because we can't predict how technology or policy is going to evolve. But the scenarios that are consistent with the sort of ambitious targets laid out for international climate policy, many of those do involve a lot of carbon dioxide removal, not just expanding forests, but also new technologies. Mm. And even still, right, in order to get that to a manageable amount, they still evolve about 90% reductions in fossil fuel.
90%. So not 100, but still 90%. That would be pretty dramatic in the United States.
Right. And that 90%, when you're getting the, plus you're getting the other 10% through very aggressive use of technologies that we don't currently have in hand to accelerate the removal of CO2.
So practically speaking, large polluters like the United States or China, India, the EU, we would have to basically stop putting CO2 into the atmosphere through burning fossil fuels.
Yes.
Wow. Is there anything I can do as an individual, given that I don't run any of those countries?
Yeah, I mean, well, I mean, as a citizen of the United States, you have a voice in how this country is run. So that's one of the things. Right? Ultimately, this is a collective action problem. And I should say that now I'm speaking as an individual scientist. This report goes as far as to say, well, the physics tells us that we need to get to net zero if we want to stabilize the climate. But right. Speaking as somebody who works about and cares about these topics, I can say, well, yes, you can, as a citizen, make sure that your representatives know that this is important to you. You can also do things to limit your individual emissions, right? Whether that's trying to, electrifying your vehicles, electrifying your heating and cooling, these sorts of things help make progress. But ultimately, this is a collective action program. And so the most important things you can do is, one, what we're doing right now, which is talking about it. A lot of people still do not hear about climate change on a regular basis. And so that's one of the reasons why it's not a top priority. And then two, talking about it with the people we've elected to help lead this country and making sure they recognize that this is an important issue.
Robert Kopp is one of the lead authors of the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's most recent assessment report. He directs the Rutgers Institute of Earth, Ocean, and Atmospheric Sciences and co-directs the Climate Impact Lab. Professor Kopp, thanks for taking time today.
My pleasure.
This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. You can find us online at byuradio.org/topofmind. We are a production of BYU Radio. We've heard a number of different perspectives on the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan and the Taliban's takeover of that country. Check out the Top of Mind podcast feed for insight on how the Taliban's control may affect women in Afghanistan, why it might embolden terror groups around the world. We also explored what this all might mean for President Joe Biden's political standing. Just look for Top of Mind wherever you get your podcasts. This is Top of Mind. It's good to have you with us. First this hour, rapper Dr. Dre and music executive Jimmy Iovine are starting their own high school. What's so special about it? And if you're feeling overwhelmed in this roller coaster of a pandemic, the key to coping is connection. Also, why Canadian dads have become more nurturing and involved with their kids over the years, while American dads have not. That's ahead on Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose.
And I'm Ciara Hewlett. Rapper Dr. Dre and big-time music producer and executive Jimmy Iovine recently announced that they're opening a unique high school in South Los Angeles. It will focus on helping students become entrepreneurs through real-life experiences. Education expert Edmund Ajapong says this approach incorporates the spirit of hip-hop, something he thinks should be part of all high school science curriculum. Professor Ajapong teaches at Seton Hall University and is director of the Science Genius Program, which engages urban students in the sciences through hip-hop. He joins me on the line now. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
What's so special about this high school Dr. Dre and Jimmy Iovine are opening?
I think a number of things. I mean, I think the first thing we think about, two celebrities and millionaires opening up a school, we think about, access and privilege. But I think, the power is that they're really just trying to think about education a little differently. And they're trying to kind of address a lot of systemic inequities that we've noticed in education across the country through their vision of what education should be. And
how systemic inequities, how are they addressing that?
Yeah, so we're talking about systemic inequity. So their school, they're not saying that their school is a STEM school per se. I'm a STEM educator, and I would love it for it to be a STEM school. But they're addressing inequities around like training and encouraging young people to be entrepreneurs, right? So when we think about schooling today and education today, K-12 schooling, we're still like really highly encouraging students to go off to college and, you know, where, you know, trade school is not, you know, heavily, I mean, encouraged. And all the thing, all those things are okay, but we have to recognize that, you know, in education and anything that we do in our society, in our world, there's no one size fits all model, right? So, you know, this model might be a model that supports a certain group of students, you know, wanting to go off to create their own businesses, to see content, not as singular. So not just seeing science as science, but seeing the interconnections between interdisciplinary approaches to content, right? So seeing the connection between science and math, and learning how both science and math can both communicate with each other to make sense of the real world around us.
So they're going to integrate different parts of different subjects together and then also give these students real world experiences with those different subjects and combining them to help them later on and to start their own businesses if they want.
Yes, that is the plan. And, you know, I think when we hear Jimmy Iovine and Dr. Dre, we think that the school is a school for music, which it hasn't clearly been specified as such, but it's a school that promotes interdisciplinary education, where, you know, students are able to kind of make sense of various disciplines and subjects and see its application in the real world, but also, you know, support students in becoming entrepreneurs. So showing them the power of content, the power of science, and how can I use leverage science to actually, you know, create an income for my family or for myself when I get older.
And it's important to note that this high school is located in South LA, which is an area where they're hoping to be able to help kids more of color and lower socioeconomic status, correct?
Yeah, yes, that's another great point. The school is proposed, number one, the school is proposed to be part of LA Unified School District, so LA Public Schools, which is a great thing. So it's not a charter school. You know, they want to work with the school system within LA, which kind of sees there might be promise, like if this kind of catches on and, you know, hopefully it's successful, that, you know, LA is the second largest school district in the country. So they might, you know, catch on and continue developing other programs and schools like that. But opening and creating a school in Lemuria Park, which is predominantly Black and Latino, shows that there's this promise, right, to support students who are Black and brown, who are of color, who historically have who have faced inequities within schools, who don't have kind of a fair shake when it comes to education in our country, and that they are the focus of this new and innovative approach to teaching and learning that we're trying to support and inspire young people to kind of, you know, become entrepreneurs, make sense of the world around them, but also, you know, make sense of content and interdisciplinary education as we move forward.
And as you mentioned, this is not a hip hop school, even though we're music school, even though it's being opened by Dr. Dre and Jimmy Iovine. But you've written that it does embody the spirit of hip hop, the way that they're setting up this school and the model. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when we think about hip hop, you know, hip hop is anchored in a few things. I mean, hip hop has this five creative elements, right? But hip hop is about entrepreneurship and it's about community, right? Hip hop started in the Bronx, in the South Bronx in particular, in the late 70s, and in the midst of economic despair, where people of color, you know, they really had little to no opportunities to go and do other things. So they kind of created this culture and this way of engaging with each other, right? And with that came, okay, I see access and opportunity, and I want to profit and benefit off of this, right? So hip hop is really about the entrepreneurial spirit, right? We're talking about LA, you know, one of my favorite rappers comes to mind, Nipsey Hussle, you know, who's passed 2 years ago, but Nipsey Hussle, he sold one of his mixtapes that he understood the process of supply and demand, and he's an entrepreneurship, and he sold one of his mixtapes for $100 for each copy and only printed about 100 copies, right? So understanding that, okay, if there's low supply, there'll be a higher demand. And that was just his thinking around, you know, releasing his music. He wasn't really, you know, he wanted a lot of people to access his music, but he also wanted to become an entrepreneur and make sure that he profited off of his talent and his music as well.
And you are a huge proponent of creating an atmosphere of hip hop and incorporating hip hop into science classrooms in high schools. Why does that entrepreneurial, oh, that's such a hard word to say, being able to have that entrepreneur mindset, why is it so important to and to have that spirit of hip hop? Why is that so important in a science classroom?
Well, it just breeds innovation, right? And it breeds creativity. You know, even, you know, I'm a science educator and I train science teachers and I work with scientists across the country. And one thing I see often is that, you know, while science is a discipline where it allows creativity, the way that it's taught and presented to young people is that it is not, right? So like, well, we're looking for this chemical reaction. So we mix chemical A with chemical B and we get chemical C, right? But in all actuality, you know, actual scientists who are in labs are mixing chemical A with B, with D and E and F, right? Just to kind of mix to create their own reactions, right? It's really about being inquisitive, about encouraging young people to be creative, that there are limitations in the world, but we want young people to kind of go to the bounds, right? And to the ends, to really try new things, to practice new things, to explore new things, right? Especially when it comes around to science content. And when we talk about Black and Brown youth in particular, right? There has to be the recognition that, you know, access to STEM and quality STEM instruction is limited in a lot of predominantly Black and Brown schools across our country, right?
Why?
So that's a great question. Why society, inequities that just have existed within our country, the way that science is taught, right? For me, I'm a big believer around like student driven instruction, right? And student centered instruction, so that instead of the teacher, you know, obviously the teacher's role and responsibility is to teach, but for me, when I train my educators, I believe that the teacher should be a facilitator of learning, right? So the teacher's not just sitting there and just spitting out and disseminating content for you to memorize, which is how a lot of us were taught, right? But as opposed to creating experiences for young people to come to their own realization and conclusions around content.
And students of color disproportionately enter STEM fields.
Yes.
Why do you think that is? Is that just because of, like you were saying, that they just don't get very quality education in science classrooms in high school?
Yeah, there are a number of reasons that research demonstrates. So one is that, you know, there is lack of quality instruction, so that even if there are students who want to pursue these careers, I mean, they get to college and higher ed, that they just don't have like sufficient grounding and background knowledge to succeed on that level in some cases, right? And in other cases, And the research demonstrates that students just don't see science as a viable career field. They're just not interested. They're not engaged. They don't see themselves as scientists. I was a middle school science educator for a number of years in the Bronx in New York City. And one of the first activities I would do with my students is to draw a scientist, right? And every year that I taught, there only been about three students who drew a person of color as a scientist, right? Mm. If I'm a young Black boy and I see scientists as old white men, right? Or like people who look like Einstein, I get a lot of Einstein, you know, lab coats and crazy hair, you know, because that's who our young people perceive as scientists. But when I ask them, how many of you know a nurse? How many of you have been to a doctor? How many of you know an engineer, right? These people are scientists. So like really demonstrating and exposing young people to the field of STEM writ large, right? And so they can recognize that there are various career fields and options like coding and gaming, right? There are so many different, you know, variations of STEM that we can and encourage and engage our young people to strive for, but there's limited exposure around that in many cases.
And why is hip hop, do you think, particularly helpful for students of color?
Well, you know, hip hop is helpful for students of color, but I argue that hip hop is helpful for all students. I mean, hip hop is it's the most consumed genre of music in the world, right? But when we talk about students of color, it's, you know, if in our school systems, we follow a very Eurocentric model, right? Raise your hand to talk, you know, move from place A to place B. The teacher's going to speak at you as opposed to creating experiences for you, right? But when we think about a hip hop mindset and we think about Black culture, which created hip hop, you know, Black culture is very communal, right? And how do we create community within schools? How do we create opportunities for young students and young people to feel like knowledge and feel seen within schools? And hip hop is a way to do that. But also, you know, on a very practical and teaching standpoint, you know, hip hop kind of speaks to all different and various learning styles, right? So like, we talk about the five elements. You have graffiti, which is a visual arts aspect of hip hop. You have break dancing, which is the kinesthetic aspect of hip hop. You have DJing, right, which could be the auditory aspect of hip hop. You know, hip hop, when engaged and implemented effectively within classrooms, can speak and support students who have various learning styles, which many of our students do in our classroom. So it is and can be a very effective way of teaching.
Does it also connect to what you were talking about earlier about how hip hop got started in the first place to create community and identity? Do you think that students in your classrooms are able to also feel that as you use hip hop?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, they're able. I mean, hip hop is the most consumed genre, right? You know, if we're doing it in school and schools are a place where we haven't seen hip hop or we don't experience hip hop, we don't experience our culture, we don't see ourselves. When educators, you know, take that plunge to, okay, let me incorporate my students' culture in the classroom, that right there is going to spark something amongst the students, and that's going to build trust. That's going to lead to like to increased engagement. That's going to lead to increased attendance. And this is stuff that I've seen in my research, right? But just by leveraging, but it has to be leveraged in an authentic way, because just as much as hip hop is about community and entrepreneurship, hip hop is all about authenticity, right? So it just can't be like, yeah, I want to do this hippity hoppity stuff, right? It has to be, if you're an educator, you taking a step back and really, and if you don't know about hip hop, learning about hip hop, right? Talking to your students about hip hop, because it's important to recognize that students in different geographical context experience and engage in hip hop in different ways.
I'm speaking with Edmund Adjapong. He's a professor of STEM education at Seton Hall University, and he studies hip hop in the classroom. So can you give us a specific example, Professor Adjapong? It might be really kind of people might not be sure exactly what you're talking about here. Like, how do you use hip hop in the classroom?
Yeah. You know, I get that a lot. So for one simple way, right? I'll give an example. In my research, I connect the five creative elements, which are the MC, the B-boy, the graffiti artist, the DJ, and knowledge of self. Those are the elements of hip hop. And I align them to teaching strategies. So for example, one teaching strategy that aligns to the graffiti aspect of hip hop as a science educator is to have students draw out a visual representation of the Earth's atmosphere. So one time I was teaching about the Earth's atmosphere, and I was just talking about it, and students were they had a little bit of understanding about what, you know, the different layers of the Earth's atmosphere, but not a full understanding. And a student came up to me and said, "Hey, mister, whenever I look up in the sky, I just see the sky. I don't see layers, right?" So at that point, it was like, okay, students understand that there are different layers of the Earth's atmosphere, but they're having a difficult time visualizing it. So I had them draw their own visual representation, right? And oftentimes when teachers give assignments to students, you know, you expect the same, a very similar assignment to come back, right, from all of your students. But in this way, it's recognizing that we all understand and visualize and see things differently. So giving students an opportunity to just to draw, right, their visual representation of the Earth's atmosphere and however they understand it, but the content has to be correct and accurate, right? So they have to use correct symbols. The data, you know, the content has to be correct, but, you know, they can draw it as however they visualize it. And that's one way to get students to come to a concrete understanding, right? As long as the content and the information is correct, but also recognizing that they see things differently and they may experience things differently, and embracing that and bringing that into the classroom as well.
And then you also sometimes will have students write raps to help them to think about the content they're learning. And so here's a quick clip that we're going to play of part of your Science Genius program. This is a winner in the 2015. And this is a rap about DNA. So let's listen to that.
It's inside the DNA, the information that we create, determine your fate. Look at your mirror, I look at your face.
Thank you so much for your time today, Professor Adjapong. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Edmund Adjapong is a professor of STEM education at Seton Hall University and director of the Science Genius program, which engages urban students through hip hop. I'm Ciara Hewlett. This is Top of Mind. Coming up next is why Canadians' dads have become more nurturing and involved over the years, while American dads have not. That's about in about 15 minutes. But first is, if you're feeling overwhelmed in this roller coaster of a pandemic, the key is connection. thank you for listening to Top of Mind. I'm Ciara Hewlett. We are living in a very uncertain time. For a minute there, it seemed like the pandemic was over, and that brought a whole set of adjustments we had to make to our lives. But now we're dealing with COVID variants and the confusion of that. So what do we do now? Psychologist Christine Klusman says the key is connection. But that seems especially difficult right now with how much the pandemic has disconnected us from our routines, habits, family, and friends. Christine Klusman is author of Connection, How to Find the Life You're Looking For in the Life You Have. She's also an adjunct professor at Palo Alto University and founder of the Connection Lab. She joins me on the line now. Thank you so much for your time.
Hi there. It's great to be here.
What would you say to someone who is overwhelmed or confused with everything that's going on right now with the pandemic, which is probably most of us, let's be real?
Yes. Great question, first of all. And, you know, I think now more than ever, it's what helps, I think, become a guiding light, you know, when in a fog, is really just reviewing your values. You know, kind of some simple tasks like that, and just reminding yourself, what is it that I care about the most? What do I stand for? I always find a values exercise to be incredibly grounding. It only takes about 10 to 15 minutes. Most people I find, you know, we talk a lot about our values, but most people can't really say them off the top of their head. And it's because we need to remind ourselves, you know, you actually need to sit down and, you know, jot them down or look at a list. So that's my favorite way to just begin to have a direction of, wait, what am I doing in this life? Where am I headed? And what matters to me?
So values, give us a specific example of what you mean by that.
Absolutely. So there, you know, there are tons of values and lots of lists online, and a good list of values will have 1 to 300 in them, but we're all really different, you know, in terms of what our top values would be, what we just wouldn't even want to live in this world without. And there are things like integrity and truth and joy and belonging and, you know, love. Again, different for all of us. And I usually take my students and my workshop participants through an exercise. And I talk about it in the book too, where you can find any list online and print it and just sit down and circle the ones that jump out to you. And then kind of go through a little bit of a honing of, you know, grouping like ones together and getting yourself to really distill down to, you know, what are my top 10, let's say, values? And the things that, you know, excite me the most. So
those values are pretty general. Love, belonging, that kind of thing. How does that help in a situation like this that we find ourselves in with the pandemic? Why would just naming those help someone to feel more grounded?
Great question. No, thanks. You're kind of teeing me up perfectly here, because the ultimate goal of, you know, being connected with ourselves and with our lives, which feels really good. Like, being connected is about living your life, you know, with intention, and you're having your behaviors be in alignment with your values. And because that feels really good, we feel really on track with our lives, whether, you know, no matter where we are, in the middle of a pandemic or a prison cell or living, you know, life as we normally remember it to be, whatever that was. But the values, you need to know your values so that you can then kind of begin to set your goals or think about your purpose in life, because they all stem from your values. And a different way into that, if, you know, values is kind of getting a little more granular. But if you don't know your values, then it's hard to feel like you have a lot of clarity in life and like, you know, what direction that you're headed in.
So it's a compass.
It is. And it's an important rock in the bucket. Another, you know, just getting back to your question of what can people do right now in the midst of all of this uncertainty? Recognizing what we can and can't control, we can't control a lot of what's happening externally, but what we do have influence over is ourselves and our own choices and our own behaviors. And often I find it also really a great place to start, kind of at the 10,000 foot level, is to think about your life in terms of sectors. And the sectors are pretty common to everybody. You can look those up online too. Like, there are big topics like health, family, friends, career, community, spirituality, and kind of look over the sectors of your life and just in a 5-minute thought exercise, contemplate, you know, which sectors are the areas that you want to be spending the most time in right now.
And how might this work in practice? Could you give us an example?
So I did this exercise recently, and I came out with that health was kind of a primary, you know, sector in my life that I wanted to focus on, but also, you know, a value too. And I got my kids inspired about it too, and they decided it was one of theirs as well. So as a family, we just decided August, we were going to dig in to mostly plant-based eating. You know, we were kind of competing with each other for, you know, the most amount of days where, you know, for movement and having little step meters. And I got really into, doubling down kind of on my focus on exercise, which normally is kind of a haphazard activity. And I started protecting my sleep and hydrating and making it kind of a community thing in my family. And I've found just that by me getting a clarity on what mattered to me the most right now, what I really wanted to focus on, and then aligning my behaviors with that, after 30 days of that, I've come away with such a strong sense that I have something, you know, something that's very clear and very tangible that I can influence, that I'm focused on, and that is with, just more importantly, it gives me self-efficacy, because self-efficacy is what we need right now to combat and counteract the learned helplessness that we're experiencing from all the things in our external environment that we cannot control. So that, if you think of it that way, in terms of your locus of control, this is a time when we need to feel effective over things that we really can do. So anything, no matter how small, even just hydrating and saying, I'm gonna kill that. I'm gonna have one thing that matters to me that I'm doing and I'm aligning with my behaviors and that I can feel proud of, that connects you to yourself, just even that one thing, because you're tuning into something that really matters to you, aligning your behaviors and getting the result.
It seems like that would also make it easier too, with just so much unexpected change happening, if you already have those practices in place, that when, you know, another change happens with the pandemic, you know, whether it's that, oh, everything's back to normal now, which can be a challenge in and of itself, then you would already know how to reorient yourself based on what those values are that we've been talking about.
I think so.
I'm speaking with Christine Klusman. She is author of Connection, How to Find the Life You're Looking For in the Life You Have. And she's a psychologist and founder of the Connection Lab. Professor Klusman, what caused you to study connection and made you realize that even in the midst of really difficult challenges in life, that this is the solution?
Yeah, I love that question, because it takes me back to when I was working at, you know, California Pacific Medical Center with end-of-life patients or patients with a severe cancer or, you know, cardiac diagnosis. And what I discovered in a lot of my patients was when they suddenly had a wake-up call related to a near-death experience, or finding out that, you know, they only had so much time left. Many of them just instinctively got very clear on what mattered to them. And they just tapped into this ability to, they wanted to live from their truth. They didn't want to waste time. They got their priorities straight, and they just, with that came a lot of ease and contentment. Even alongside the grief and the difficulty they were experiencing, they were enjoying feeling really connected to themselves. And that's when my teammates and I really started observing just this type of well-being and wondered, you know, how do we do that without waiting for a crisis? Because it seemed to be something that what we saw in these patients was that it was innate. They had it. The wisdom was there. All they had it, they needed was the motivation.
Well, and that seems totally different, opposite of what you would expect. You know, someone who's brushing up against death, you think that it would be really depressed and react that way. But you found the total opposite.
Well, you know, it was a mix. And I said that it was not all, you know, not all of my patients were that way, but some of them were, many of them. And they were fascinating because you're absolutely right. We expected the depressed and anxious, the grief reactions, and that's what we were called in to help with. But we, you know, a lot of the clients who were struggling more were more defended about what their experiences were. And the clients who were in grief, you know, that wasn't necessarily, as I mentioned, the grief could sit alongside, you know, the connection to self and being able to tap into their truth. So it was a really interesting mix. And it was the resilience, the ones who were highly, highly resilient that we don't typically study or even see those clients because they're probably doing a little better. But those are the ones that I felt like I learned more from them than they did for me.
So what was it about those people, these terminally ill patients, that they were able to connect to themselves, connect to their values and priorities, as we've been talking about, and what they really want to focus on in their lives and being intentional and being able to look on the bright side, really, of what was going on with them?
Oh, you know, I wish that I could answer that. That is like the million-dollar question, because it was really different for every single one of them. There was no thing. What I think was what we sort of observed and studied, and now we study, you know, in our lab, people who kind of embody these qualities, is we look for their commonalities. Like, what do they have in common? And the people who were more resilient and had more access to their inner truth and were acting on it and were more connected, they tended to speak their truth more. They tended to do more self-care. You know, they had regimens in place, things like many of them meditated or were, you know, spent time in nature. They did things to still kind of nurture either alone time or contemplation time. They journaled, not all of them. I mean, it was all different. These are just kind of common factors that we've found in our research for people that are highly connected. So there are things that will prime the pump, so to speak, like good, you know, ways of tending to oneself, taking good self-care that can lead you to become, like, what we learned is that connection starts with the self. So that before you really worry about connecting with others, it's, you need to tune into, you know, what your own needs and wants are and taking good care of yourself. And then it becomes a much more natural and easy and even effortless task to connect to others because you're coming from a more grounded, authentic place.
Why is it so hard for us to live in line with our values and priorities, so much so that, you know, you've started a whole connection lab and written a whole book about this? It seems like that should be the easiest thing that we do. You know, if those are our values and priorities, it seems like we should be able to follow those.
I agree with you. I mean, I would say the great news is that it's actually not hard. But like you know, like something as simple as hydrating, it's easy to forget every day and easy to forget kind of the impact, because the impact is not immediate, you know, the cause and effect. We're just a society of benign neglect. You know, it's easy to just get away from our priorities and, you know, get caught up. You know, we live our lives kind of caught up in a flurry of activities when getting connected requires becoming intentional about how you want to live your life. And that requires a bit of like spaciousness and you know, contemplation. And you got to slow down a little bit for that. So it's there. I mean, you can turn this around in a day if you wanted, but you need to first prioritize it. And it's not what we're in the habit of prioritizing.
Christine Klusman is author of Connection, How to Find the Life You're Looking For in the Life You Have. And she's also founder of the Connection Lab and is an adjunct professor at Palo Alto University. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's wonderful. I really enjoyed it. Thanks for having me.
I'm Ciara Hewlett. This is Top of Mind.
Coming up next, why Canadian dads have become more nurturing and involved with their kids over the years, while American fathers have not. I'm Julie Rose. Thanks for tuning in to Top of Mind today. It's good to have you with us. America and Canada are similar in a lot of ways, maybe most ways. But our different systems of government have given rise to some pretty specific differences in the way parents parent. In particular, the way fathers parent. Kevin Schaefer is studying the fascinating contrast he has found between Canadian and American dads. He's got a book coming out early next year called So Close Yet So Far Away. It's about this very topic. Schaefer is a professor of sociology and Canadian studies at Brigham Young University, and he is with me now. Welcome. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Give us one example, just to start, of how American and Canadian dads are different.
Sure. So Canadian dads are far more engaged in caregiving, things like helping their kids go to the restroom, changing diapers, getting kids to bed, those sorts of
meaning
tasks.
They spend more time?
They spend more time doing those things than do American fathers.
Like a lot more time?
Significantly more. It's 14 hours per week for Canadian dads. It's about 8 hours per week for American fathers.
Ooh, coming up on almost twice as much time
right.
They spend. Interesting. And is that a new development?
It is. So about 35 years ago, there was data that we were able to collect from both Canada and the United States at the same time. And at that time, there was no difference between Canadian and American fathers and how much time they spent in caregiving tasks. So fast forward 35 years later, that giant gap has emerged.
Is it because Canadian dads have started spending more time, being more engaged mm-hmm. over those 35 years, and American fathers just kind of stayed where they were 35 years ago? Is that trend
so
line?
So both have increased. So both American and Canadian fathers have increased the amount of time that they've spent over the last 3.5 decades.
So even 8 hours a week
is it increased,
is better
right.
than what we saw back in the, I guess, 80s
Correct.
For American dads.
Yep.
Okay. But both have increased, but Canadian fathers have just increased in a much more significant way.
That's right.
Their engagement. Okay. How about the quality of that time?
Mm-hmm.
How do you gauge that and what differences do you see?
Yeah, so we measure it in a different sorts of ways. One way to do it is just how warm they are with their children, how engaged they are in terms of emotional engagement, meaning how often they talk about problems, talk about daily events, engage in school activities, those sorts of things. And if you look at sort of those quality measures, you also see substantial differences between Canadian fathers and American fathers. So if you were to separate this out, so to speak, and say, you know, the most highly engaged dads, what percentage of Canadian fathers are really highly engaged and what percentage of American fathers are really highly engaged?
Mm.
You get differences. About 55% of Canadian fathers are really engaged in warmth and that those emotionally supportive behaviors. You get between 25 and 30% of American fathers who are that highly engaged. So there is a substantial difference in those kinds of behaviors as well. It's not simply an issue of caregiving, but it's an issue of all forms of parenting.
So let's talk about why that difference would be. As I mentioned, you know, America and Canada are pretty similar in a lot of ways, but we're different culturally in some ways. Is some of this just cultural, that maybe what it means to be a man or sort of ideals about those kinds of things are different between America and Canada?
I think there are some differences. I think that they're relatively small. Political scientists and cultural sociologists tell us that really Canada and the United States are almost the two most similar countries in the world. Like, if you were to pick two countries that were almost exactly like each other, Canada and the United States tend to be those two countries.
Despite the sort of like pop culture jokes about how Canadians are a lot more apologetic kind of thing. When it really boils down to it, if you saw a Canadian and an American interacting in their daily lives, you would have a hard time deciding which was which.
Exactly. Okay. Right. One might like hockey more and one might like football more, but sort of beyond that, it's not that big of a difference.
Yeah. Okay.
But what really causes this difference are the differences in policies.
Huh.
In the United States, we talk a lot. We have a lot of rhetoric about family policy, and we have a lot of rhetoric about how much we care about families. But almost nothing in our policy suggests that we do care about families very, very much. We just don't have a systemic family policy in this country. Whereas in Canada, over the last 30 plus years, both conservative and liberal governments have advanced family policy in really substantial and significant ways. And I think that is what really causes the difference that we've seen emerge over the last 3.5 decades.
So what is something that Canada started doing in the last 30 years that would encourage more Canadian fathers to engage with their kids?
So I think one of the biggest ones is paid family leave. Canada has paid family leave. They've had paid family leave for several decades. They just refurbished their paid family leave law, which also includes what's called a use it or lose it policy, where dads get 5 weeks set aside just for themselves. The United States is one of three countries in the entire world that doesn't have any paid family leave policy. So that's one enormous difference between the two.
So the United States, it's basically left up to the employer.
That's right.
And there is a requirement that for a certain period of time, a person can't lose their job, at least a mother in most cases.
That's right. Yeah.
But you're saying in Canada, the government guarantees it somehow.
That's
every
right.
single father, regardless of their employment, is able to take 5 paid weeks off.
So they have to qualify. Something like 90% of Canadian fathers qualify because it's done through the unemployment insurance program.
Okay.
So you do have to sort of pay into the system.
Sure.
But the vast, vast majority of Canadian fathers qualify for those policies.
And that makes a difference how for fathers?
Well, we know that when fathers take paid family leave, that they are more involved and more engaged, and they're more involved and more engaged over many, many years. So it's not simply
the first 5 weeks of a child's
life. Yeah, right. So it's just the first 5 weeks and then everything goes back to normal. But they learn that they are good at this, right? They're good at caregiving.
Oh. They
are highly involved and engaged in that caregiving process, and that lasts for years and years and years. I think the other part of that is the mere existence of the policy sends a message to Canadian fathers that there's an expectation that they be highly involved and highly engaged in the lives of their kids in ways that we don't have those policies in the United States, and therefore that message is not sent in the same way.
Okay. So a Canadian father who was there for the first 5 weeks and probably spent a majority of that sort of like trading off doing, you know, feedings and diaper changes and soothing the baby overnight and kind of like trying to spell his partner and getting sleep, that kind of thing.
Right.
You know, it's not like rocket science, but there's some bonding that takes place. But then also just that when the kid is 3 years old, the father is more likely to be engaged in helping with the toileting and that kind of thing.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
None of which he was actually doing when the baby was an infant. Like it's just connection. So some
right.
of it is just an emotional connection that takes place.
Right.
And 5 weeks is enough
to build that foundation.
Evidence
from the United States suggests that it's, you know, maybe even less than that. Maybe 2 weeks does that.
Now, the United States has not and never has had. So it's not like something changed 30 years ago in which we stopped having paid family leave.
That's right.
So in what way do you think just the lack of it can explain how fathers have stalled out? There must be something else, because that dates back a long time. Like, we've never had paid family leave.
Right.
I'm asking that in kind of a confusing way. But I guess I'm asking what else could explain this massive divergence that took place 30 years ago?
Right. I think that that policy is one of them. I also think that there's a really important difference in terms of economic inequality and its effects that it has on how families operate.
Okay.
So, for example, in the United States, about a third of American fathers work at least 50 hours a week. So an enormous number of American fathers are spending a lot of time at work.
A third work at least 50 hours a week.
Right.
Okay. Which just practically speaking means there's less time to go to T-ball games or to, you know, be home for the bedtime stuff.
That's right. In Canada, that number is 10%.
Oh.
So there's a massive difference in the amount of time that Canadian and American fathers are spending at work. One reason for that is what's called the Canada Child Benefit, which is tax rebates that go back to families monthly that help them pay for the necessities of childcare and everything else that comes with having a family. Kids get that direct benefit every month. It gets deposited in the bank accounts of families.
Parents get a check.
They get a check.
Every month.
They get a check every month.
Depending on how many kids they have.
Okay. Correct.
Which is something that American families have experienced for a few months now in the United States from the pandemic relief measures. But America has typically handled, we have had child tax benefits, but it doesn't usually come monthly. It kind of comes as a lump sum when you file your taxes
in
April.
And when you get it matters. So we know that, for example, in Canada, that is being spent on necessities. Whereas in the United States, that gets usually spent on one of two things, either consumer debt or it gets spent on consumer goods. Mm-hmm. It doesn't get spent on necessities because it comes as a one-time payment that we're all familiar with.
Feels like a windfall and you're going to do your big splurge.
Oh, I got my $3,000 check and I'm going to, you know, buy a new bed or something like that. In Canada, I think because that comes once a month, what they do is they spend it on necessities. What we also know is that temporary measure in the United States, we already have data that suggests that there's been a shift in how money is being spent by families using that tax credit.
Okay. That is being spent more on necessities.
Correct.
Interesting. Okay. And so why would having access to that money... So you're supposing that the access to that money makes it so that a father can work less hours.
That's right.
Or the family's feeling a little less financial pressure, which means it's simply a matter of time. Fathers have more time, therefore they're going to be more engaged.
That's right. Like, I think that most American fathers are working many, many hours because they have to in order to support their families.
You think they would be doing more with their kids if they had the time, if they weren't experiencing that economic pressure?
Our data suggests that that's true, right? When we ask dads, you know, what are the major barriers to you spending more time with your kids? The necessity to work is always the number one answer. And when you ask them, what would you do in order to spend more time with your kids? The answer is almost always cut back on the amount of time I spent at work. But those two things, as you can, you know, see, are diametrically opposed to one another.
Yeah. Do Canadian and American fathers have different ideas of what it means to be a good dad?
I don't think so. Yeah. I mean, I think when we ask them questions about attitudes in our survey, and when we looked at the differences in attitudes about fathering in Canada and the United States, there really are no differences between the two countries. So Canadian and American fathers agree on that. It really is a question of the barriers that exist to involve fatherhood.
Speaking with Kevin Schaefer, who's a professor of sociology and Canadian studies at Brigham Young University, he's got a book coming out actually due early next year called So Close Yet So Far Away. Yet So Far, Fathering in Canada and the United States. You did find that American dads tend to be stricter and use more physical discipline. Is that right?
Yeah.
How would you explain that difference?
I think it's a couple of things. I think one is that there are some pretty important regional differences that exist between fathers in the United States that don't exist in Canada. So that's more common in southern states, in part because it tends to be a more conservative culture, and there is something about sort of conservative cultures and the use of harsh discipline against kids. Another is just the amount of stress that exists in the two countries. So when you have that time crunch that we were just talking about, that creates a massive amount of parenting stress. And stress usually is manifested in that kind of parenting, those kinds of behaviors, right? Where the frustration comes out, and as a result, there's the use of harsh discipline. So I think that explains it more than anything else. The United States is also a much more religious country, and there is a connection between religiosity and the amount of harsh discipline people engage in.
Okay. Along the lines of the financial and economic pressure, you've also pointed out that you think the healthcare system in Canada could be contributing to the way father's father. What's the connection there?
Right. So we have an issue of, you know, for those that are not familiar, the Canadian healthcare system is a single payer healthcare system. So essentially it's beyond tax revenues that are taken out of paychecks. It doesn't cost anybody any additional funds.
Right. You get your health insurance from the government.
The government. That's right. Yeah. Whereas here in the United States, obviously we have this very strange hybrid mix of private insurers and public insurers and people who don't have health insurance,
right,
et cetera.
So it's a lot, you're a lot more likely to be without insurance or to have an insurance plan that requires a very large upfront payment.
That's right.
In the United States than you are in Canada.
That's right. So one, that creates financial stress, right? Okay. We know that, for example, 2/3 of all personal bankruptcies are due to healthcare costs. But it also creates all kinds of other stressors and it causes time crunches. So what we did is we looked at unhealthy fathers in Canada versus unhealthy fathers in the United States. And what did unhealthy fathers in Canada, how much time did they spend with their kids? Were they engaged in these kinds of positive parenting behaviors? And then unhealthy fathers in the United States. And there's a massive difference between unhealthy fathers in Canada and the US.
Hmm.
We think it's because one reason is because American fathers have to deal with the bureaucracy that comes with our healthcare system. We know that American fathers are spending hours per week on average dealing with the bureaucracy of the American healthcare system, having to deal with insurers who don't want to pay bills or who want to fight you on every potential treatment. So if you have a chronic illness, that's just a massive time suck that just does not exist for Canadian fathers at all.
So you've been surveying thousands of dads in America and Canada for years now, and looking back at other survey data that does something similar. Has any of that affected or have made you notice things in your own parenting as a father?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's one I get a lot. And I think, you know, my answer is I'm not sure that it makes me any better of a father than it otherwise would. But I think what it does do is it makes me feel a little more guilt about the things that I don't do right. That being said, I do think it does emphasize the importance of the amount of time that I spend with my kids and the kinds of behaviors that I engage in.
What do you recommend American fathers who are inside this system that is making it harder to be a good dad, quote unquote? What do you recommend fathers focus on?
So I think at the individual level, it's really going to be an issue of finding time, finding the kinds of employment that allow you the opportunity to be highly engaged with your families. But, you know, I think this is much more a systemic problem than it is an individual problem. And from that point of view, I think what it will require is American fathers to stand up and say, we want to be involved and we want to be engaged in the lives of our kids. And we're going to demand from our political leaders across the spectrum that they start to engage in family policies in the same way that they did in Canada. Canada is not an extremist country by any stretch of the imagination. It's very easy to sort of say, well, we should be like Sweden or we should be like Norway. That's just not a politically feasible thing in the United States for a variety of reasons. But we could engage policies like those that exist in Canada, which has a very similar political culture to the United States. And we could demand from our political leaders that they actually actively engage in family policies and put forward policies that are going to help mothers and fathers be more engaged in the lives of their kids. If we do that, that I think will have a massive effect.
Is there anything, just in about the 30 seconds we have, is there anything in the Biden administration's agenda, which much of it is wrapped into this very large budget plan they're trying to negotiate right now, anything in there that you think is worth advocating for?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the Biden administration has put forward the first real proposal in more than, you know, multiple decades that looks at actually engaging in paid family leave. And that is, I think, where we need to start.
Kevin Schaefer is a professor of sociology and Canadian studies at Brigham Young University. He's got a book coming out early next year called So Close Yet So Far, Fathering in Canada and the United States. Thanks a lot for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Top of Mind is a production of BYU Radio. Cleon Wall, Ciara Hewlett, and Kyle Riemond produce the show. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us, topofmind@byu.edu, or find us on social media. We're on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at BYU Top of Mind. Our website is byuradio.org/topofmind. I'm Julie Rose. We'll talk soon.